for us, you know, we look at it as, you know, an opportunity to develop a relationship with an individual and work together, create content that builds their brand, that builds our brand, is generally kind of like, you know, lifting all of us up.
Welcome to another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast, The Cusp Show, where we talk about the business of sports, media, disruption, innovation, maybe some mystery. I don't know. We'll find out. I'm Joe Favorito, once again with my co-host Tom Richardson here in the middle of April 2024. Tom.
Hi, Joe. Good to see you. It's amazing how quickly we sports fans can change on a dime and go from being obsessed with basketball to at least for 4 days being obsessed with golf. I'm in two different fantasy pools right now. So if you see my eyes averting, it's only to check the leaderboard and the status of my teams. But I'm not even that huge a golf fan, but for, I think golf events are actually good examples of how to use fantasy or more casual gaming for people. So I'm a little bit obsessed with the Masters. How about you? Are you following?
Cool. I am a little, and I'll tell you a very funny, non-traditional Masters story about how someone is mastering the Masters who's not a player. Mm-hmm. So this week I got a message from my college roommate's son, who's a senior at the University of South Carolina, and I'd helped him out and helped a friend of his out with some career advice. He's like, I'm working at the Masters this week, and I'd like to send you something. I'm like, I don't need any more swag. If you get some grass, maybe something, I don't know, whatever it is, that would be kind of cool. I said, what are you doing there? I figured, like, you know, he's working in corporate hospitality. Maybe he's, caddying, doing something on the broadcast side. He said, no, I'm working in the gift shop at Amen Corner. It's been a tradition. He said, when you get here early in the week, and he's a business major, he said, I brought my resume, and I've already connected with people just casually coming in who start talking to me about, you know, what I'm there for. And you can't meet any bigger high net worth people than in the gift shop at Amen Corner at the Masters, which I thought was tremendously entrepreneurial on his.
What a fun experience. Yeah. So, good for that. Yeah. So, I'll just mention one more thing that I'm going to share this with my class. We talk a lot in my class about digital experiences and the importance of user experience and user interfaces. And I have to say that Augusta National has, I just actually said this in a Slack to my colleagues at my company, since we are in the app business. It's really the best experience for live sports that's being streamed on multiple streams at a time. If you haven't checked out the app itself, it's even pretty good on the website without the app. But I've got the app on my iPhone as well as my iPad, and I've got the tab up in my browser. And you can toggle between different views. You can choose your different audio. It's really nicely done. And then you can actually just simply press, at least on the apps, a little thing on the bottom right to include a watch part, or just launch a watch party, or get some additional information. So all the stuff we talked about, like going back to the conference in the fall, Joe, about these newly imagined experiences of how you watch live sports. So this morning, when I was watching the four screens on my phone toggling back and forth, I was like, this is the way definitely to watch golf, but I think it would apply to other sports. So well done, Augusta National.
Well done. So very entrepreneurial, by the way, I guess.
Well, considering they're the paragon of tradition, you know, a tradition like none other, whatever it's called. They do things that I really like, including limiting the amount of advertising when they're actually on broadcast television. That to me is an absolute pleasure, because if there was one takeaway beyond the greatness of Caitlin Clark and the exciting women's tournament that I have for March Madness, was like, there were a lot of freaking ads, man. Yeah. It just seems like it's going up every year, the ad load, and it's so annoying. And I know I'm not the only one that thinks that.
So pivoting to ads, NIL, basketball, entrepreneurship, star building. Let's talk about sneakers.
And culture. And the crossover of culture.
So funny you put those two words together, because our guest today is going to touch on a bunch of those things. Ryan Duke is the founder of Crossover Culture, which is really trying to disrupt a space and build a space that's very hard to do in the sneaker and culture world, given the behemoths that are in that world. But before we get to that, and we're going to hear Ryan's story too, which Tom and I are very intrigued to hear, actually, for the first time, that he's not a mass murderer, but that's okay. That's another story. But it was interesting, Tom, as you saw, I've often said it, and during the college football championship game, I was stunned that for all the money being spent on NIL, there was exactly one athlete who was featured in a commercial, in a traditional commercial during the college football championship. As March Madness moved along, and as we got to Monday night, there had to be, I would bet, 15, 10 to 15 at least, well-positioned athletes from various schools, some of which were great that you knew, although State Farm went out of their way to make sure that Caitlin Clark had an Iowa jersey on, so you knew who she was. Some of whom had great spots who you had no idea who they were because they looked like athletes that may have had a sweatshirt on, you know, in a commercial for Invesco QQQ, but they never said who they were, which was a lost opportunity. But I just thought it was interesting. First of all, lots of women, which I thought was really great. Juju Watkins being one, who's coming back, obviously. And by the way, most of the LSU women's team, who's done probably more for NIL in the commercial sense than probably any other school, just for their starting five. But seeing how that space has developed, Ryan, who's joining us today, has really taken a very interesting approach on bringing athletes on for endorsements in NIL from the very young age to moving on to when they're going to be successful. And we're really excited to hear that story because we haven't talked a lot about sneaker culture, basketball culture, and we have talked about, but it's great to hear more disruption and how people are building businesses. So Ryan Duke, with that on entry, welcome to the Cusp Show.
No, appreciate it.
So we got to start with the big question in the room was how did this develop? What was the impetus to do this? Tell us a little bit about your background and your thoughts about doing something this ambitious.
It's a little ambitious, yeah. I think, you know, this really comes from like youth. So I grew up in Portland, which is Nike's headquarters, Adidas USA, and one had an office there, Under Armour, all kinds of footwear companies. It's kind of like, you know, Pittsburgh is a steel town, Portland is a sneaker town. Playing basketball, of course, when I was younger. It's just kind of in the blood, in the DNA when you're in that environment. And, you know, my training and background is in industrial design. And so I've been doing that since college. And, you know, for me, I was always interested in entrepreneurship, even as a kid, you know, hustling up different money and different things as a kid that you do, right? Especially to afford the sneakers that I wanted at the time. And, you know, then I was in the Bay Area in San Francisco for school. Of course, that's the hotbed of entrepreneurship. So I kind of got the blood and the DNA of the sneakers, and then, you know, merged into the entrepreneurship world in the Bay Area. And I just kind of waited until I felt like it was the right time to get in this market. Obviously, this market is dominated by one giant player, and then other large players peel off, you know, parts of the business. So for us and the partners that I had in building this, we kind of look at sneaker culture and how it matches the game. So if you go all the way back to like the 50s and 60s, it was a very simple game, pass, cut, shoot, kind of fundamental stuff. And you had a very simple shoe like the Chuck Taylors, which later became like this kind of pop culture icon.
Yeah, I remember wearing them when I was young when I played basketball. That's everybody did.
There you go. Yep. And then, like, you know, in the 70s, you started getting a little more funk, a little more flavor. And then you had colors coming into the shoes and different pieces and different parts. So we look at 90s was like the most kind of like aggressive iteration of this, where it was very much an isolation game. You dumped it into Jordan, Shaq, Hakeem, whatever, Patrick Ewing, let them do their thing. And that's really where like signature product for shoes really exploded. And it was built around individual players, and you want to be like Mike, you want to be like this person, you play that position, you have that body type, you wore that shoe. And of course, like at the time, there's a lot of competition between Reebok and Nike, Avia, or, you know, in that process as well. But Nike really kind of, with Jordan, of course, took the lead and took it over. Then like late 90s and early 2000s, you had the street ball kind of culture of basketball come in. And that's where And One came in, Dada Supreme came in with that similar kind of vibe. And that was a big shift in terms of how kids approach the game, and that kind of era leaked into what's currently, you know, the style of play in basketball. And so we, you know, we kind of looked at this kind of changing culture. It's no longer about positions. It's no longer about body types. I play pickup ball with a kid who's 21. He's 6'8", 240. I've never seen him go into the paint like at all. Like, he shoots threes. That's what he does, you know? But he's not like what you typically say. Oh, he's just like a wing. He's just like a guy. No, he's a big dude. So we looked at that and as part of like the change and shift in sneaker culture and basketball. And, you know, we don't design shoes around like a player or a body type or position. We design it around kind of the fit, feel, and structure. So you want something that's bouncier, something that, you know, absorbs impact, something that's, you know, more stiff, something that's more flexible, so that players over time can learn what really fits them in their game, not kind of like fitting into a position or a body type. And then also as the game has evolved, really the handle is the most dangerous weapon in the game. You got a great handle, you can get to your spots on the court, you can beat your guy, you know, you make things happen, make plays for other people. That's the most dangerous play. That's the most dangerous thing in the game. And so hence crossover culture. And then the kind of up a level from crossover culture and referring to like the style of play. Like, basketball is a place where if you got game, you can get on the court no matter where you are from all around the world. You know, you earn it, you get your run. So it's kind of like a place where people meet. And it's just, basketball for me has always been a great kind of, you know.
So that's a good story. I would love to hear a little bit more detail as to how you actually founded it. Like, there had to be a moment where you said, I'm going to go for this. You had the idea, but you obviously had to take steps to launch a company. Could you tell that part of the journey?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it came in the course of like after school in Bay Area. I started working for a number of different startups as my own kind of contractor. I never really worked for anybody else. Is always, you know, work myself and helping people out. So I spent a couple of years kind of really observing different startups and how they operate and you know, things that I thought they did well, that they didn't do well, and started kind of building relationships. It wasn't something like I had a tapped in network of a bunch of like, you know, industry vets and stuff like this. It was something I built organically. And my co-founder, Eric Bullard, we met and about a year later, you know, he had been involved with Data Supreme when it was starting up and really built that. And, you know, he had been pioneering kind of different new brands into the consumer space, not in basketball after that, but other categories. And, you know, he kind of, we just started talking. I said, like, this is what I want to do. This is what the opportunity I see. And he said, well, put something together. I'll put it in front of, you know, Foot Locker. And, you know, we laid it all out, product, brand, positioning, the whole thing. And, you know, Foot Locker guys actually came out and were willing to like review what we're doing. He said, look, you guys have a very good shot here. You're not going to beat Nike. That ship has sailed. But, you know, you do things right, you have a really legit opportunity here. You need to, but and they kind of like laid out the roadmap for what it takes. And then from there, we started building. It bootstrapped it and then got, you know, friends and family involved and seed and just kind of step by step built it. You know.
Very impressive. And when you went into C, did you do VC or have you done VC yet?
No. So we did friends and family, bootstrapped it just with revenue and, you know, personal stuff. And then we partnered with a group in New York about a year and a half ago. And they are it's a family owned business that has been in the sneaker and apparel, you know, industry for 30 years. And so we kind of, now we sit on top of their infrastructure as we're ready to scale.
Nice. So walk us through as you're ready to scale, like size of the company now, you know, don't have to give numbers, but units available online, global, and then talk a little bit about how you've picked athletes, who they are, and how that's kind of played out.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's still a very small company relative to everybody else in this category. So for us, and we sell domestically, like Dick's, we just had a shipment with Dick's that came out. We just launched our women's line last year. So it's, you know, step by step. It's not the scale of Nike and those kinds of places yet, but the pathway is there for us. Internationally, we sell in Japan, we sell in Europe, we sell in Australia. We've done well kind of in those spaces. In terms of the athletes, I think, I mean, I mentioned to you guys before, like it really self-selects for people who want to be leaders that are different. It's the kind of kid who's like, I'm not afraid of taking the last shot to win the game. I don't mind the pressure. You know, I want to win the game. I want to be the one responsible for that. That type of mindset seems to be, you know, the type of person that's attracted to doing something new and doing something different and taking ownership of the process. And but
And
those, yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
I'm just going to say, and related to that, I saw that you had a big announcement recently with these five young basketball
Right.
stars. Can you
Yeah.
talk about that and not just who they are and what you're doing with them, but also how, I'm curious, just from an outreach and recruitment standpoint, how do you get them to buy in?
Yeah, I mean the athletes we have are, we're really excited to work with these I mean, they're individuals. I think that's a lot of thing. A lot of times fans from the outside kind of like they see them as athletes who play in the game, but not like individual people outside of that. And these are really great individuals, like high character people, exciting, interesting, like innovative. You know, Rob Dillingham, obviously, he was the first kind of like bigger name to sign on with Donda Academy. Of course, when that kind of collapsed, he moved on. And then he was kind of like the another big first name to go to Overtime Elite as an undergrad or as a, you know, amateur. And he sacrificed, like at the time, being the McDonald's All-America game to take that path. So he's a guy who has really kind of carved his own way. He's been successful and has taken some criticism for that. And, you know, now it's paying off for him in a big way in terms of his next leap up to the NBA. You know, JC with Ohio State, she's fantastic. Like she's like a wonderful person, you know, individually. But she's also like a highly successful player on the court. And just the way she approaches, you know, life and everything is very kind of like down to earth, and she's not caught up in the hype so much. And then, you know, Trey, he just finished at Overtime Elite. Trey Parker, he's going to NC State next year. He's like super energetic, like super creative, like he's like a big character. So some of the content that we have that's coming out with him is going to be, you know, a little more edgy, a little more fun, a little more aggressive. That fits his kind of personality. And then with like Boogie and Boogie Flan in New York there, he just finished his senior year at high school, you know, city champion back to back. You know, he's very much like kind of like New York vibe, right? Anywhere in the city he goes, like people, you know, oh, that's Boogie, you know, that's Boogie, this kind of thing. So like everybody has their own kind of character. And Jordan Burks, who was at Kentucky this last year, will be returning. You know, he's a guy who, like, you know, people have talked about him, like, oh, he's this, he's that, and he's always been kind of wanting to prove who he really is and show who he really is. And he's kind of earned his stripes his first year at Kentucky, and I think he's going to do really well next year. But even like when we started talking with him, his first request is like, can I hook up my mother's, you know, junior high girls team with sneakers? Not like, what can I get for myself, right? So I think everybody's just interesting characters and interesting people, and I think that I enjoyed that part of it, like the individual, you know, people.
So what's the remit when you go to them and say, what does that business deal look like? I think that there's been a lot of talk and kind of like this, you know, veil of secrecy around NIL. Is it, we need you to do X posts? Do we need you to show up in these places? Is it based on sales? Is it based on business that they can bring in? When you look at, and this is kind of, you know, you look at the group that you have, and they're from very young kids to players on the edge of the NBA, all with their own individual followings. But when you know, you go to them and you sit down with them, what does that look like? And I bring that up because I was listening to a radio interview with Danny Hurley with PJ Carlesimo going into Monday night's championship game. And he talked about one of his young players, freshman now, who will be going to the NBA. And he's like, the reason why he fits here is because he has parents who are not fans, they're parents. And they don't get into the fan game, and they support him in the ways he needs to be supported. And that's what we need here to eliminate a lot of the nonsense. And there's a lot of nonsense in NIL right now, but we'd love to know what those, when you're in the room with those young people and their representatives, whoever they are, cutting those deals, are they specific? How do you kind of figure out what looks like success for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a growing thing, and people haven't really nailed down exactly what success looks like, you know, in the long term. It's still very new, right? You know, for us, you know, we look at it as, you know, an opportunity to develop a relationship with an individual and work together, create content that builds their brand, that builds our brand, is generally kind of like, you know, lifting all of us up. And then kind of seeing how the teams work together and seeing, hey, would this be a long-term fit for as you graduate to the next level in your process? And, you know, the teams around players are really important for their success, you know, and how they approach it and how they execute things. Yeah, I'm not sure that NIL stuff is like an immediate ROI in terms of like, okay, this person posts and this person makes so much money. That's not really, I think, you know, dialed in yet.
Okay.
It's more about
when you look off of that, you mentioned something just now, length of deals. So there were companies, I remember looking this year at the sneaker companies that have team deals in the NCAA tournaments for men and women. And it was pretty much, I mean, I don't know if Under Armour had any, but it was pretty much Nike and Adidas. And I remember there was a company on the shoe side and on this the uniform, no, it was on the shoe side, who had two, it was Ready was the name of the company based in Pittsburgh. They had two or three teams a couple of years ago in the tournament where they were lucky, like you, they picked the right people, right time. And as soon as as soon as those teams hit the tournament, here came the big money and the deals blew up. So how do you safeguard against building all this equity with these athletes, young athletes, hoping that they're going to be around? Or is that not a focus? Is it more like, let's just kind of see where they go. We treat them well. And even if they go on to someplace else, you know, we have a resonance here that kind of bounces along, no pun intended, for wherever we're going to take our business.
Yeah, I mean, I think we also are realistic as where we're at in the process in the marketplace. And the demands that we make on people are very different than what Nike or some of the larger brands do. We're much more open and flexible. We're much more collaborative with athletes and what fits for them. And so the deals kind of take shape based off of like individual, you know, availability, really, and interest. And, you know, long term, some athletes may stick with the brand and maybe the right fit with the brand. And we work together on creating a deal that's long term as they go into the pros. Some may not. I think for us, it's not really like art in general. We don't approach this trying to control a player or their arc. We really want to make the approach much more collaborative and supportive, just in general as a brand. And you know, we want to know what their goals are for this kind of relationship and a relationship, and maybe that fits with us, maybe it doesn't. You know, if that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Tom.
Yeah, right. Ryan, is the brand building of crossover culture broadly beyond these new players you have or all the players you represent right now happening primarily through the players? Because, you know, one thing I think we all learned watching Nike get big was once they started signing players, they kind of dominated the marketing vibe of the brand. You know what I mean? Despite the fact that they would continue advertising, doing the traditional marketing things that everybody does. Where do you stand with that right now? Because it's expensive if you're going to go into paid marketing, as you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, players are a big part of it. You know, players are connecting with their fans and connecting with the people in a way that, you know, a brand doesn't necessarily, you know, do in the same way.
Right.
Until, you know, 30 years of kind of saturation and it's made that happen. So players are important for us. I think it's also about kind of like learning from them and seeing what works, seeing what fits. But generally as a brand, I think that, and even sneaker culture and basketball culture, you know, it used to be, you know, several decades ago, like the dream was the NBA. That's every kid's dream. Now the dreams have really expanded into short-term dreams and medium-term dreams, being featured on Overtime with your mixtape, you know, getting an NIL deal. There's dreams that kids can really reach and achieve in a 1 or 2 year timeline, or a really clear timeline that we can kind of be involved in and help in that timeline. Beyond just like the NBA, I think a big part of like the excitement of youth and basketball is like the potential. And sometimes the high school and amateur and collegiate athletes embody more excitement in that potential. And then once you get to the NBA, like the cold, hard reality of like you're one of the top 300 players hits and maybe you're not a star, right? You're highly successful, but you're not like the guy, you know. So we kind of tend to, as a brand, to try to operate in the earlier phases of like those dreams. A lot of tournaments and things like this.
So you mentioned the tournament. So are there other sponsorships that you guys are doing in addition to the athletes, like AAU teams, individual sports events, yeah. You know? So talk a little bit about that. But the other question I'd like to know is, NIL is now here. Whatever happens in the future, it's not going away. Was this, if you look back and say, could you have launched the business the way you've done it now 3 years ago even? Or has NIL really opened up those doors, at least legally, to figure out how you do that? So tell us about the other pieces of how you're growing the brand. And then also, you know, you're sitting here now. Is NIL really the thing that got you to where you guys could actually kind of pivot this and move it forward?
Yeah, I mean, so for us, grassroots is really important. So we do a lot of grassroots events, tournaments, you know, from middle school to high school, camps, things like this. And that's really about kind of like reaching out to our kid and our customer, giving them an experience, letting them touch and feel a product, try it out. And, you know, that kind of response from those things is really what's grown the business, you know, so far. We find like once we get some sneakers on a kid, they fall in love and they come back. For us, the big challenge is like, okay, you're scaling this, you know, this kind of strategy takes time. The kind of NIL landscape has unlocked a accelerator in this process in terms of that world. We will see over time what that impact is, but it's a way for us to engage with players, because a kid who's playing middle school hoops is looking at the kid playing high school hoops and seeing what they're doing and what they're where they're going, almost more than most professional players outside of like the biggest names. And so for us, it's a way to connect with fans and customers and players.
Hey Ryan, I was listening to you talk, thinking and wondering, did you read Shoe Dog about Phil Knight?
Of course.
I figured that.
Good question, though. I mean, hey, you read.
There's so many interesting parts of storylines in that book, but one of them that occurred to me while you were talking is that the less glamorous side of the business you're now in is the whole manufacturing supply chain thing. And that's something I got an appreciation for from some of the war stories that Phil told in that book, his trips to Japan and fighting, with the distributors. Like, it was classic. How are you managing all that while you do all this kind of front-facing stuff with the athletes and the communications and things?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. How are we managing all that? I think, same way, I was over in China I've probably been over there 20 times,
really?
Building this thing and meeting with suppliers and, working your way up from like, the minor league of suppliers to now the A-level, suppliers. And just that process of evaluating and learning and, who's going to deliver and how do you protect yourself. And it's definitely.
And were you on your own doing that, or did you get some consultants or advisors? Because that seems very intimidating as a business proposition.
Yeah, I mean, we've had different people at different points in the process who've been there before. It's also the kind of thing that, like, the individual really matters. Like, if you were working at a large company as the head of, sourcing, for example, that's a very different experience than if you were a consultant manufacturing for other smaller brands, finding the right people that fit, finding the factories that the relationships are really critical and important. Because look, we're not making any factory over in Asia millions and millions and millions of dollars at this stage. Like they're making profit off of, you know, off of larger scale businesses. So finding partners that are invested in the growth of your company is also really important.
Cool. Who is your audience, by the way? It's not the Skechers audience, I would imagine.
No.
Not Howie Long, Joe.
Yeah.
I mean, typically it's a younger kid. You know, in the past it's skewed male, and we've like in the last year we've launched on the women's side. Just Great. The women's business is so much smaller at this stage, but that's definitely growing. It's definitely something that we're pushing hard for that. It just hasn't been given a lot of love in the last, you know, several, you know, even last decade, right? Until now, like there's a lot of excitement going on. So I think there's more love being put into it. But it's definitely young. It's, you know, it's high school and lower. And then like the back half of like the millennial generation who is, they've been through it all. They've seen all the hype. They've seen the big releases and like, oh, they've seen the same thing, you know, for literally 15 years. Like, oh, let me try this something new here. You know, they put the sneakers on. Oh, these are legit. They perform well. You know, let me get this a shot, you know?
Cool. Three words. You tell me which one is more important and how you'd put them in. Culture, comfort, and cool for your audience. Which are the most important ones and why?
Very good. I'm impressed, Joe. It sounded like you had a prepared question, but that was good improvising.
I think that ultimately comfort is, and I would translate that as performance. Like this is a performance product, you know. It is what kind of seals the deal. Cool factor is like the gate. Like if you're uncool, a kid won't wear you. You know, you don't have to be the coolest, but you can't be like nobody. You can't walk into a gym and somebody clown you because you got those sneakers on. So like once you get over that initial hurdle, like, you know, a kid's gonna try these on, he's gonna wear them. Oh, these are legit. Tells his friends, and he's kind of like the one who discovered the brand. And discovery is something that's really, you know, for us, like. I remember when AN1 first came out as a kid, I was like, oh, what is this? I've never heard of this before. Like, this is so fresh, right? So giving that kind of experience to a kid is part of the brand, you know, the first time you discovered something.
Yeah, that's a good
and,
point.
You know, the culture part of it is really like, look, we speak to a very specific audience. This is not, you know, Skechers. This is not, we're not making walking shoes and hiking shoes and everything else in the mix. Like, we are a basketball brand. That is what we do, you know?
All right, I got my own version of Joe's question. Three words. By the way, before I ask the question,
we've never done this before, Tom.
Are you the CEO as well as co-founder?
Yeah, so I work with my partner in New York, and so we run the company together. Basically, I'm the brand; he's the business. So
okay, so three words. Which one is your favorite part of the business, at least at this moment in time? Because you're relatively new doing this.
Sure.
General management, marketing, product.
How do you want me to do you want
well, in other words, like or? Some people like running a business as you know, the CEO and managing people and doing deals and stuff like that. Some people really like focusing on marketing and brand development and social media. Some people really like attending to the product and the manufacturing and supply chain and things like that. So you're a young entrepreneur slash now founder CEO. What are you feeling in terms of your preferences?
Oh, I think it's all a mix. I think I'm interested in all of those things. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. You know,
okay.
If I didn't care about the product manufacturing, it wouldn't happen, right? And if I wasn't interested in setting up and managing and like building the brand, it wouldn't happen. You know, and marketing is something that is changing all the time, and you know, trying to keep track of that is something that, like, if you're not aware of it, it ain't happening. So I don't think that any of those is necessarily like priority or
okay.
You know.
Do the athletes that you have now have input into shoe design and style, or is it more just kind of amplifying the message of what it is you've already created?
Well, I mean, different times, different things. So like some of the NIL stuff, they're wearing product that we have available. And then over time, you know, some of those kids will create, you know, colorways that they want to, you know, do. And we've been working with Taurean Prince out here with the Lakers in LA. He's been wearing the Fatale most of the season, and he created like 50 different colorways, and we're working on kind of like the next shoe, and he's in the nitty gritty of like, okay, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to, here's the idea for this, the materials and the fit. So different people will have different, you know, interest levels in, you know, getting behind it. But for us as a brand, like, we invite people to come in and fit in where they are interested.
Cool. Last question from me, at least for now, until I have another last question. But when you go in the room with these deals, who's doing the deals on the other side? Is it parents? Are there representatives? You know, because you're dealing with guys and women who are 21 and 17, I guess, right? So, and then how do you identify, like, this is a good deal with these people? Does it have to actually be a fit beyond the athlete with the people who are in the room?
Oh, the fit is the most important thing for us, I think, because if you can't work with the people that you're getting in a deal with, like, it's not going to happen anyway. In terms of the people that you know are kind of like on the player's team, that varies. It's parents, it's advisors, it's NIL agents. You know, it's different people and different, you know, different kind of roles. You know, I personally like to be as close to the player as possible. You know, somebody who's known the player for many, many years, whether it's a parent or advisor, because they just understand the individual more, and the communication style is different. And I'm much more of an informal guy. So let's just talk about, hey, what do you need to do? What do I need to do? Instead of kind of like the agent speak world as well. You know,
cool. Actually, off of that, and then I'll shut up. Can you tell us, like, deals you haven't done, just in general, not who they are, like, what's the most outrageous request you've gotten so far from a player or an agent?
Oh, there's definitely been some interesting requests. I mean, look, I think, you know, as a high level athlete, you know, you have to have kind of a very high, you know, self-worth, you know, in order to even mentally compete in this space. So everybody believes that, you know, they can move the market, they can sell sneakers, they could be the star. If you didn't, you wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't think you even have a shot at the pros, right? And we have to balance that with kind of like, you know, the reality and the nuts and bolts of sneakers and the margins of the sneaker business and the mechanics of the sneaker business. But, you know, people ask for $1 million, you know, and have very little kind of like following and very little kind of impact in relation to that request. But, you know, if you don't ask, you never get, I guess, you know.
Right. Tom?
Ryan, the last few years, the whole category of top athletes as investors has just skyrocketed. It's kind of crazy how many are doing essentially versions of venture capital. Curious if you're able to say this, if your ambitions continue to grow and you need more capital to grow faster and bigger, is that a kind of an appealing space for you to go in, like finding, I'll just use one example that everybody knows of, Kevin Durant, 35 ventures. He's made dozens and dozens and dozens of investments, because this seems like it's tailor-made for a high-level basketball player, a successful basketball player who actually is investing.
Yeah. I mean, for us, one of the principles of the brand is ultimately player ownership. Like, this is the player empowerment era. You know, it's happening. Right. It happened before in free agency with NBA. It's happening in collegiate and amateur with NIL. This is the player empowerment era. And a number of individuals have tried to kind of start their own brands. But it's very hard to be a top level professional basketball player and also operate and run a successful business. So, you know, part of the reason we've built this is that we're creating kind of like the platform and proving all of the different components of a successful business. And eventually, when we find the right partners, they'll come in as owners, which Taurean is coming in as an owner of the brand. And that'll grow. And eventually, it will be a player-owned brand, you know, over time. You know, it's about like finding the right kind of player for that. You know, Magic Johnson talks about, like, when he was coming out as a rookie, you know, Phil Knight came to him as a young guy. Hey, come join Nike. We'll give you stock. He's like, nah, man, I want the cash, right? Turns out he lost like $2.8 billion or something like this. But there's other players that Nike talked to, like I believe it was Spencer Haywood. There's different versions of the story, but like he took it and maybe his agent sold it for cash, or maybe it didn't, you know, something happened. But he also got that like equity opportunity in Nike early on, and for whatever reason it didn't pan out. Wow. Like Kobe was gonna start his player owned brand, you know, before, you know, his untimely passing. Different people have this is the next disruption in this category. And we are creating the platform for those people to come on, because also it's much harder as an individual. If you're coming in with 3-4 different players coming into a player owned brand, you diversify your risk. Nobody, if one person gets canceled, the other three people are stepping up. So that's, you know, long-term, that's ultimately the vision.
That's really sensible.
There's a famous Stephen Barry story with Stephon Marbury, who, you know, Steph invested a lot of time and money in a brand that everyone thought was going to be great and was great for about a year. And then Stephen Barry's went bankrupt and all the equity went out the door as well. So anyway,
there's upsides and downsides. And that's why it's a specific individual, you know,
That's a business that you're in too. So, Tom, you want to kind of take us through the last?
Yeah, we do a last segment. Although I just occurred to me, Joe, we did not warn Ryan that we do this. It's not too taxing, Ryan. Don't worry. But we end every show with a few questions. Let's start with the fun one. I'm not sure if you're in a position to do this, but do you have any mementos or tchotchkes from your involvement in sports in recent times that you really cherish? That's like the best thing you got in the business.
I don't know that I don't know. Cherish is the right word, but like our high school team got, you know, we went to the state semifinals, and then like 20 years later, they're like, put you in the high school Hall of Fame. And like, they had the original jerseys and uniforms that we wore. The coach had kept them all these years, which is kind of killer. Like, oh, man, this is crazy. You know?
Oh, that's fun.
That was kinda cool. You know,
I'm sure with the work you're doing, you know, when you're our age, you're going to have tons of things to answer that question. Cause it's funny, for the older guests that we have, who've been around the business, you just end up collecting all these different mementos and collectibles that are really kind of define a career ultimately after you've been working for so long.
The good things and the bad things of the career. Like, oh
yeah,
man.
Well, you keep the good ones, discard the other ones. Tell us how you stay smart. How are you keeping up with everything you need to keep up with about culture, the basketball world, NIL, etc.? What are you reading? What are you listening to? How do you stay smart?
Oh, it's people. It's people that are in the ground, connected to, you know, the grassroots basketball, player conversations. It's people. Like the stuff that you get kind of like from the surface on media, it's just the top slice. Like the real conversation is happening from person to person at a tournament, at a game. That's where the conversations are happening. You know, that's where the culture really lives.
I don't think we've ever had that answer before, Tom.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good point. Yeah. I mean, I think if you're in a type of job or business where you are lucky to be interacting with tons of different types of folks, and you are curious, and you're a good conversationalist, you can elicit a lot of good information and insights, which I subscribe to that approach too. So that's a good answer. The second one was about careers. We ask our guests to offer career advice. We have a lot of students, graduate students listening. Your story is super interesting because you were industrial design, you said, undergrad. You came out, you worked, you didn't work for companies per se, you did contract jobs, and suddenly you're now running what appears to be a great company with lots of potential. What lessons have you learned? What career advice might you offer to other young people getting their careers going, especially?
Yeah, you know, I mean, everybody says, oh, follow your passions, right? This is right. Like the advice to everybody. And I think that's total bullshit, frankly. passions are your hobbies, right? You need to find what you are good at, what you are better at than other people. That's what you need to find. For me, it happens to align with a passion, happens to, but 90% of what I do is not what I'm passionate about. You know, mm-hmm. It's the nitty gritty of the grind of making something go from zero to nothing to execute and deliver and these kinds of things. I think you have to really try a lot of things early and find what you are good at as soon as possible so that you can then, you know, dedicate your time to what you're good at.
That's a great answer, Joe.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a nice, simple thought, but I couldn't agree with you more. And to your point, Ryan, you don't see that when you're 22 getting out of college necessarily. You may not even see it when you're 25 or 30 or 35, but if you keep trying, you'll find something.
When you're 22, you can make mistakes.
Make
four mistakes to get to what you're good at sooner.
You know? Yeah. That's one reason why I asked you the question about the three words, you know, management, marketing, product, because ultimately specialization is a track that people get on, whether they like it or not, or when I say specialization, just a certain track, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I think if I were one of your investors, I would have loved your answer when you said, I really need to be thinking about all three, because that's the right answer. When you're a CEO, if you're the head of marketing, you'd say, I live and breathe marketing and I just want to build a brand and all that. And you're not worried about going to China and worried about the players necessarily day to day. But you have to really manage it all right now.
If you're going to start a company and run a company, like, you have to know all the aspects at the scale that we are. You know, large companies are different, but you have to know front and back everything about what's going on, the components that make it successful, the components that are weak. You have to know it.
Yeah. Where can folks find more about Crossover Culture? I know you just recently launched a TikTok account, but run down the list of places people can interact with it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously our website, you know, crossoverculture.com, Instagram, TikTok, you know, there's some stuff on Facebook. But those are the primary spots. You can get it at Dick's, Dick's.com, Hibbett's right now, mm-hmm. in terms of retail. Those are the spots.
Yeah.
The most relevant one's going to be our website. It's got the most information.
Yeah. Are you doing direct sales as well off of the site? Okay.
Yeah,
I just want to confirm that. Yeah.
Tom, Joey, what size are you? I forgot to ask. I'm just kidding. So,
what size am I? 9.5. I'll have to look at the line, but we'll swap some Columbia swag for a Crossover Culture.
Get you guys on the court.
Okay. Yeah. maybe to officiate. I'm not sure.
Coach.
Everybody's got to play a role.
Cool. Well, once again, you've been listening to The Cusp Show with Ryan Duke, the founder of Crossover Culture, talking about NIL, hoops, entrepreneurship, giving us great advice, has told us where he can go, and it was really great to have you on. Another brand, Tom, that we're going to have to follow and see kind of how this goes, and hopefully get Ryan when he's coming east back on campus too to talk about his innovation and where it's going to go, you know, over the next couple of months and years.
Yeah. Thanks, Ryan. Really appreciate it. And we wish you well building the business.
I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Cool. Once again, you've been listening to The Cusp Show. I'm Joe Favorito. For my co-host, Tom Richardson, and our producer, Mike Schroeder, you've been listening to Ryan Duke, the founder of Crossover Culture. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you down the road.